Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to NBN's Drugs, Addiction, and Recovery podcast. Once again, it's your host, Geert, for today. And I'm very excited to be joined today by Professor Ruszewski. Hello, Mark. How are you doing?
I am doing fine. How are you?
I'm very good. Thanks so much. I'm glad you're here.
Glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So, Professor Ruszewski, together with his colleague, Professor Kant Patel, they recently, well, this fall, their book is being published called The Opioid Epidemic in the United States, Missed Opportunities and Policy Failures. It's published through Routledge. And, I'll leave it to Professor Ruszewski to explore the contents. But before we do that, maybe you could briefly introduce yourself, tell the listeners how you came where you are professionally speaking.
Okay, well, first of all, I'm a political scientist with Missouri State University in Springfield, Missouri. I am a retired political scientist, so it's a professor emeritus. I retired in 2014, but I've continued to write and actually to teach a little bit. So as my wife would say, I'm not fully retired yet. There's some jokes about that. We'll just skip those for now. Patel and I have been writing, Kant Patel and I have been writing together since about 1990, and we've done a number of books. The major one that we've done is Health, Politics, and Policy in the United States, and the fifth edition came out a couple of years ago. And as part of that, in one of the chapters, there's about five or six pages devoted to the opioid epidemic in the United States. It's almost like a Reader's Digest version of the book that we decided to do. And we decided, and I will give Patel the credit for it, this was basically his idea, that he wanted to do a book that fully explored the opioid epidemic. And the title is a little bit misleading in two respects, because there's not one opioid epidemic. There's been several opioid epidemics. And the other part of it is that we have a chapter that looks at the opioid problem in other countries and internationally. So it's a little bit broader than the title would suggest. We spent about a year and a half putting the book together. Our publisher was very happy to work with us on this, and the result is the book that's just come out.
Yeah, so I think the historical overview is well, it's super well referenced, and it's very very broad. In general, what was the main question you were trying to answer, actually?
Well, we're asking why did this happen, basically? What were the causes behind the various opioid epidemics? Who was responsible? What could have been done and what wasn't done? So the focus that we have is on policy failures. This is in the subtitle, and missed opportunities. There were places where things could have been done that weren't done, where policies could have been enacted to go in a different direction, and they weren't done. And there's a lot of blame to go around. One of the things We use the old Walt Kelly, who did the Pogo cartoon, and he has his main character saying, "We have met the enemy and he is us." And I think that's a pretty good way of looking at who is responsible for the various opioid epidemics.
And with this "we," you mean everybody in the U.S.?
Well, I wouldn't say that. That's probably a little overstated, but it's there's an awful lot of people. I mean, there's government agencies, there's private actors, there's people on their own who, on the addiction, a whole range of things, from pharmaceutical companies to distributors to pill mills to doctors and things like that. There's just a lot of people to blame for this. It's not just one person or one group of people.
Yeah, very hard to pinpoint, and a wicked problem, so to say. Maybe because, I guess many of our listeners are to some degree familiar with the current crisis, but could you maybe go about a bit about the first two crises as well that you describe in the book? What happened in the first opiate crisis?
Well, I want to start a little further back, because there's a fair amount of history in the book. It's not just political science-y stuff. Opium's been around for a long time, and it's a painkiller. And it's been used as a painkiller, and you could see this. I think we cite that opium was been used back since 4000 BC. So that's a long time. You could see this in the Civil War when morphine, which is an opioid, was used as a way of killing pain, which created a bunch of morphine addicts, which was really a problem. And then you look at the whole drug situation in the United States, where there was virtually no regulation of anything in the 19th and early 20th century. And then the Harrison Act comes in around 1914, and it pretty much says all drugs are illegal and using drugs are bad. And that's kind of the way we looked at drugs for a long time. And for a substantial portion, we're still doing that. So we had a period when the drug war begins. And again, we think of the drug war as beginning with Richard Nixon in 1971, because he used the phrase. But you can go back to the Eisenhower administration, and they were talking about the drug problem, and they kind of used the phrase war on drugs, not officially. By the time Nixon comes in, there are drug problems. And a major drug problem was heroin, which is an opioid, and particularly among those who served in Vietnam. Drugs were pretty widely available in Vietnam. If I can go aside and tell a little anecdote about this.
Please do.
I was in the Air Force during the Vietnam War. I never went to Vietnam. And I, one of the people I served with wanted to go to Vietnam, and he asked to go to Vietnam, and our base commander kept turning him down, and finally said, "Okay, go." So he went to Vietnam, and then I saw him a couple of years after I got out. We got out. I was in graduate school, and he came by, and he said, "Why in the world?" Because this guy was like a beatnik type person. "Why in the world would you want to go to Vietnam? 53,000 people died there." And he said, "The marijuana was really great." That's the kind of thing that you had with heroin. So the Nixon administration was really concerned about two things. One about heroin among Vietnam veterans, and the other was about marijuana, which was associated with minority groups, just like opium had been associated with Chinese. There were two opium wars in the 19th century between Britain and China. Britain wanted to continue selling, China didn't. We had the Chinese Exclusion Act, and we just saw the Chinese as, having these opium dens and so forth. And we tended to identify particular drugs with particular groups of people. So opium in the early years was with the Chinese. Heroin in the late 1960s, early 70s with veterans. Marijuana with minority groups. And so Nixon declared this war on drugs. And there's an argument that could be made, and we make this in the book, about where that kind of fits into Nixon's strategy. He ran in for president in 1968 with what was called the Southern Strategy, which was aimed very much at Democrats in the South. There's been a lot of change in political makeup between the two parties since then, and which is kind of an anti-black strategy. And we also have a quote from one of his aides, John Ehrlichman, saying that the real reason behind the war on drugs was the Vietnam veterans. They were anti-war and minority groups, more than the drugs themselves. So you started seeing some of this. And one of the things that happened is 1970, Congress passed the Controlled Substance Act. And this is what sets up the schedule of drugs. So depending on what the drug is and its medical use, it gets more or it gets less government regulation. A lot of opioids that we're going to talk about are actually Schedule II drugs. So that's kind of the first one, first part of this. A second part, well, the first part is the opioids in the early 20th century. This is the second part. The third part, and there's stuff that goes on in between, begins around 1995 when the FDA approves OxyContin made by Purdue Pharma. And that starts the current wave of the opioid epidemic, which is taken depending on who you talk to, as many as 730,000 deaths from 2000 to about 2019.
What are the, what's the lower end of the estimation? Because the lower end is about
680,000, something like that. It's a considerable amount. Wow. So that's the three periods. And then you have sort of the waves. And this is a Center for Disease Control and Prevention idea that there were three waves of opioids that were being misused. And one was, first was prescription opioids, which is what started in 1999 and particularly 2000. And then it moved to heroin, and then it moved to fentanyl. And heroin is more powerful than the prescription drugs. It's less expensive. Fentanyl is much more powerful than heroin. It's less expensive. So you have the three periods, you have these three different waves, depending on what time period we're talking about.
Yeah, I see. Would you say that there's, in terms of the I mean, you've spoken of the image and the ethnic association, but would you say that there's a profound difference between the actual problem on the ground between the three crises?
Well, yeah. They hit different sets of people. And the biggest one, of course, was this third one that begins in 1995-2000. And I'm going to go back a little bit and get to your thing. So we talked about the Nixon administration. The Reagan administration faced a different drug problem, which was the crack cocaine epidemic. And then the Clinton administration faced a different problem, though it clearly overlaps the opioid epidemic, which was methamphetamines. So this is all part of the war on drugs and the emphasis on punishment and interdiction and incarceration and things like that. Those epidemics, those issues involved a different sets of people. So if you looked at the crack cocaine epidemic, particularly in the 1980s, we're talking about urban blacks, minority groups. If you're talking about the opioid epidemic in the 21st century, we're talking about, and this is a stereotype of working lower class whites in particular areas of the country. So let me state, first of all, that the United States has the worst opioid epidemic problem in the world. Canada is number two, but it's a far away number two. And the opioid epidemic, and this is true in Canada as well, was at least at first limited in where it was taking place. So in the United States, it was in Appalachia. And in particular, it was in this corridor that included Ohio, Tennessee, Kentucky, and West Virginia. And the people who lived there lived in rural areas. They were low-income areas. The healthcare systems in those areas were very underdeveloped. The level of education was lower than in other places. And there was a lot of economic distress because coal was big, but then coal is less big than it used to be. There used to be auto plants there. Auto plants have moved away. So there was a lot of economic distress. And that was a factor in this. Now, having said that, let's go back one step. Opioids, compared to these other things, have legitimate medical purposes. So what they do is deal with pain. Okay, and that was what the prescription opioids were doing. Pain was a real thing. We decided in the 1990s that pain was an important thing to look at. We started developing societies, the American Society for Pain Management and things like that. And prescribing opioids, which is a Schedule II drug, was allowed by the states. Unlike all these other things, cocaine and methamphetamine and marijuana, now we think has some legitimate medical uses. You start with the medical uses. Fentanyl has legitimate medical uses. But there was a problem with how they were used. And we can talk about that.
Yeah. Yeah, I figure. Yeah, perhaps I'm wrong, but it does sound like an interesting parallel between the first and the third wave of opioids, because, I guess the first wave of opioids back in the 19th and early 20th century was also started by, medical use of morphine, right?
Yes, but then you started bringing the opium trade from China and Chinese immigrants coming in. So it kind of morphed away from morphine. That's a terrible way. I didn't mean to do that.
So the stage is set, I guess. Now your book is about policy. Before we move into the opioid policy or the opiate policy, what is policy in your opinion?
Okay, so there's a lot of definitions in the public policy literature, and I'm not going to bore your audiences with all of that. There's one that I like, which is really fits in nicely with what we're talking about, which is the decision to do or not to do something. And it's not a one decision, but a series of decisions over a period of time. So you may have something that's pretty significant, but there's a lot of other things that are going on. So government can decide to do something. Government can decide not to do something. There's a whole discussion about, why they may decide to do something. And in the case of opioids, there are a lot of indicators that were out there that we could look at. We could look at, just like we do with the coronavirus pandemic, we could look at overdoses. We could look at hospitalizations. We could look at emergency ward visits. There's the federal government, U.S. federal government has the an early warning system called DAWN. We could look at deaths. And all of these become indicators that there's a problem. The question is whether government is going to deal with that. But if the problem becomes significant enough, if there's enough people who are being affected by this, then government is probably going to take a look at it. That's the simplest way. We can go into more, but that's a different book.
Yeah, of course. No, it makes perfect sense. Well, you've touched upon the first one. So what was the government response in the first opiate wave? Was it just the Harrison Act, or was there something before?
Well, that was the main thing. The Harrison Act and trying to keep the Chinese out through the Chinese Exclusion Act. Everything with the Harrison Act, everything is illegal. All these drugs are illegal. You know, cocaine, Coca-Cola, one of its ingredients was cocaine. That's where the coca thing comes from. And it was a lot of these patent medicines and no regulations. You could do whatever you wanted. And the health, the medical profession was not well developed yet. That didn't happen until early in the 20th century. And it was, you know, we talk about the Wild West in the 19th century America. And that's kind of the way it was with medications. I mean, you have these guys, you know, saying that this, I'm going to give you this elixir and it's going to, you know, cure all of the ails that you have, even the some you don't know that you have. So certainly some regulation needed to be done. Whether it needed to be done that way, you know, wholesale, everything is illegal, using drugs or immoral, that's kind of an interesting question. So the government's response was, okay, let's keep the Chinese out because they're bringing opium with them. And then all of these drugs are illegal. And it stayed that way for a long time.
And so you also give a brief evaluation of the Harrison Act or of the policy response in general. What would you say?
Well, they weren't terribly effective. I mean, people were able to get the drugs that they wanted. There aren't enough law enforcement people there still aren't enough to wipe out the thing, assuming that that's actually a good idea. And so, you know, it was the earlier version of prohibition, just didn't have a constitutional amendment to it. And we know that while there was a decline in use in prohibition of alcohol during prohibition, there was still alcohol that was being made and consumed during that time period.
Yeah, understandable. But it does sound the government response in the in general sounds sort of similar to the war on drugs that started in the 60s, no? General prohibition.
Yeah, except that they didn't have they weren't doing the interdiction kinds of things. It was just, it was illegal, we'll prosecute you if you have it, that kind of thing. But it didn't go all that much beyond it's illegal and if we catch you, as opposed to there were, there was treatment involved, even with the war on drugs. That's an interesting thing about Richard Nixon in the war on drugs, is that he probably put more emphasis on treatment than his successors did. Nixon's an interesting character. Again, I don't want to go off on another tangent, but there were some good ideas he had. Whether the war on drugs was a good idea, I think that's questionable, but I think the treatment was. You have people who are addicted, why not go out and help them? We never put enough money. We still do not put enough money into treatment. And most of the treatment is privately run. There's been some help in recent years, but most of the money, law enforcement, interdiction, incarceration.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So I think there's been quite the shift. Well, you already pointed that out with the prime example of the contrast between looking at the crack cocaine epidemic and what user group that had compared to the user group of the third opioid wave. What was the main difference between the policy reactions now?
I mean, compared to then?
Yeah, between the second and the third wave.
Well,
is it as clear cut as it seems?
Well, I don't know that it's all that clear cut. I think there's the Obama administration put less emphasis, which is not the same as no emphasis, on the law enforcement stuff and a little bit more on treatment. The Trump administration, there were some laws that were passed that were had some treatment-oriented stuff, but I there wasn't really that much change. It didn't seem to be a particular emphasis of the Trump administration. And the Biden administration, as far as I can tell, hasn't done all that much. There's the American CARES Act, which passed in January of this year, 2021, has broadened Medicare and Medicaid a little bit and the Affordable Care Act. And so there are more treatment options that we have. You know, the other thing is that we ought to point out about the second and third period, and particularly the crack cocaine opioid period, the 2000 period, is not that just they were different groups, but how they were viewed. So in the earlier periods, the Nixon period and the Reagan period, they were viewed as bad people. Of course, they were minority groups, and it was their fault that they were addicted. With at least the beginning of the opioid epidemic in 2000 or so, again, lower white working class, they were viewed much more favorably and said, well, you know, it's not really their fault, and we're not going to punish them, though we'll punish some of the people who were pushing the stuff. And the media did that as well. There's the difference in how the media portrayed them is really interesting. There's some documentaries that have come out. In fact, there's one that's coming out next week, October 13th, called Dope Sick, based on a book by Sam Quinones, which is a wonderful book. I highly recommend that to everybody. But it's one of a series of books that look very, and documentaries that look very favorable. I don't want to say that. That look with compassion. That's the best way of putting it. With compassion to those who were addicted to opioids. You didn't get that so much with particularly the crack cocaine epidemic, or those who were involved with the drugs during the original war on drugs. So there's some differences in how we viewed them, differences in the policies that we had to a certain extent, And I think that makes something of a difference. You know, we don't really have a crisis. Nobody's calling it an emergency because of the opioid crisis, though Trump did do that at one point. But it wasn't nearly the same emphasis that we had in earlier years, including the Clinton years.
One of your chapters is about this perfect storm that happened in the 90s. Could you explain a bit about that and what the role of the different agencies was in this?
Okay, so let's go back to what I said earlier, which is that opioids have a legitimate medical purpose, which is to treat people who have pain. That's an interesting issue to deal with, pain, because at least back then, there was no way to objectively observe how much pain somebody had. You would ask somebody how much pain you're in. I know that there are cancer patients, and I can think of a former colleague who died of cancer, who was incredible pain and was taking morphine. And for those 3 months that he was suffering from this, he was in and out of consciousness on that. And the morphine eased this kind of thing. So you have people who are in pain. There's no question that there are people who suffer from chronic pain issues or acute pain issues. Then you had the beginning of development of pain medications by companies like Pharma and like Purdue and J&J. And OxyContin, as I mentioned earlier, gets FDA approval in 1995. And then you have the medical profession looking at pain as the phrase that was used was the fifth vital sign. So when you see somebody, you say, well, you know, what's your temperature? What's your blood pressure? How's your heart doing? Are you feeling any pain? There was, as I said, journals, there were societies, there was state legislation that allowed doctors to prescribe. The FDA also allowed the use of pain medications. And so you had this situation. You had the pain in the patients. You had medical societies that were moving to treating pain, and you had this medication. So that's kind of the perfect storm on this. The problem was that this was not done well, which is what led to the addictions. So I may be anticipating one of your questions. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the one of the questions was, are opioids addictive? And the pharmaceutical companies said, no, they weren't addictive. And there's an interesting, and there were some studies that they cited. The most interesting one was a letter to the New England Journal of Medicine as far back as 1981. So there was a study conducted in a hospital of patients who had undergone surgery. They were taking opioids, I believe morphine, while they were recovering in the hospital, and then they were released. And the letter said nobody got addicted while they were taking the opioids in the hospital. That was then translated into opioids are not addictive. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you took a very limited situation, okay, a very short period of time under doctor's care in a hospital, and you extrapolate that to the larger world. Opioids are not addictive. And that's the first part of where the pharmaceutical companies come in because they make money by selling their medications. When people started getting addicted, well, there were a couple of things. Pharma, and there's a lot of, not pharma, Purdue Pharma, there's a lot of number of books that focus on Purdue Pharma, and there's a documentary that just came out a couple of months ago that focuses on Purdue Pharma based on the book, was not the biggest. At most had about 25% of the market, but it was really aggressive in marketing. And there's a whole literature on pharmaceutical companies marketing their products to doctors. And the doctors were kind of amenable to this. And pharma was one of the more aggressive ones, both in saying it's not addictive and saying you should use the product because it, you know, it's really good and it helps the people. The problem was that a patient could take the OxyContin and they could crush the OxyContin and they could take it directly and they would get it addictive, because not only does opioids relieve pain, but it also hits your pleasure centers. One of the things we said is, you know, you get pleasure from eating or you get pleasure from sex. This is higher than either of those things, or even maybe both of them combined. And once you do that, you say, oh, we like that. So let's do this again. That's how addiction works. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and at the same time, pharma is saying, you know, some of the patients aren't responding as well as we would like. I keep saying Purdue. why don't we use bigger doses? So you could go from say 20 milligrams to 120 milligrams and you get a bigger dose, you get a bigger high, and they make more money out of this. So Purdue's marketing people were pushing for doctors to do higher doses, and they were doing that. Okay. Another problem that you had was when there was more concern about increasing concern about addiction, pharma changed its formulation. So it was more time release thing and said, well, you couldn't really crush it and get the same kind of effect. The problem was that the time release pills were supposed to work for 24 hours. But like a lot of time release pills, the cold medication is a good example of this. They don't work for 24 hours. Maybe they work for 10 hours, but you're not supposed to take another pill. But if you were getting high on this, your brain is saying, I want more on this. You start taking more of the pills.
Yeah.
And so you have Purdue saying it's not addictive. We have our studies to show that it's not addictive, which as a number of books have shown, were incorrect. We want you to use higher doses, and we're going to really push this thing. The other companies, J&J is another one, we're doing similar kinds of things, and that begins to create the addiction based on prescription opioids. So that's that first wave that we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
Okay. And then what happens is... that as the overdoses and the deaths from them start becoming more apparent, the state government and federal government starts taking notices. But they take their time. For example, CDC issued its first alert in 2006 and its first guidelines for using opioids in 2011. So that you have all of this time when there were no guidelines on this. What the state started doing was, and there's other things going on. You started having doctors who would just fill prescriptions. You know, you'd come in with a fake prescription. They'd give you a whole bunch of pills, some of which you would take, some of which you would sell. You'd get them at these pill mills. There were pill mills in Florida, for example. The pharmaceutical companies were sending millions of pills. I don't have the number in front of me because I don't want to rustle any paper, but you might have a small town of like 31,000, and over a 2-year period, they'd have millions of pills being shipped to that town. Okay.
Wow.
They weren't all given as prescription medications. They were being sold. So you had, that was another aspect of this. The second wave begins when the states start regulating. And one of their policies was prescription drug monitoring programs, which were a little late coming. My home state of Missouri just adopted it. It's the last state in the country to have a prescription drug monitoring program. And the
when did the first ones come in?
The first ones, I think California was among the first to do this. And that may be, and I don't have this in front of me, so I might be off a little bit. They may have done this as early as the 1990s. So they were really early. But most of them come in the 2000s, in the 2010s. And so what you had with people who were addicted were doctor shopping. So you get a prescription from this doctor, and then you go to another doctor, and you get another prescription, and they take it to a pharmacy, and the pharmacies would fill all of these. And there's another story there with the pharmacies like CVS and Walgreens and Walmart would just kind of fill these things. So with the prescription drug monitoring program, if they work right, anytime an opioid was prescribed, it would go into this registry. And the doctor could look at them. There was no mandate to look at them. It depended on the state. And the pharmacies could look at this also and say, well, this is the 100th prescription you've given in 2 months or something like that. We're not going to do this. But between the prescription drug pharmacy programs and the reformulation of the opioid medications, prescription medications, the addicts were finding it more, and which also raised the price of prescription drugs. The addicts were looking for something else, so they moved to heroin. Heroin was cheaper, it was easily available, it was stronger, and then they would move to fentanyl, which is way stronger. And so there you have it. So you have this perfect storm, and you've got millions of people who are involved with this.
And what about the FDA and the DEA in this whole story? When did the, because, well, now by now it's become sort of a front page story or well-known story about the opioid crisis. What has the government response been so far in terms of policy?
Well, from the federal government standpoint, there's payment for treatment, for example, through policies like Medicaid. Medicaid will pay for treatment for addiction. Medicaid was lambasted because in the early years, Medicaid would pay for the prescriptions for its Medicaid recipients. Some people have blamed Medicaid for the epidemic, which is unfair because insurance companies were doing that before Medicaid got into it and continued to do that. So Medicaid will start paying for some treatment. I think Medicare is now doing some of that. There's more money going to states to pay for treatment. But there's also the interdiction thing, you know, the law enforcement thing. Let's charge doctors who are obviously misusing this. Let's close down the pill mills that are providing these things. So it's a range of things that government has done at the federal and the state level to deal with this. Probably not adequate to the nature and the extent of the problem.
Okay, that was what I was going to ask so far, because we're right in the middle of this, of course, but so far, what would your evaluation be? Is it going in the right direction?
Well, not really. There was, in 2018, there was a decline in opioid deaths. But since then, it's gone up, and there's new data for 2020 that showed that there were 90, again, I don't have this in front of me, but I think there were 93,000 drug overdose deaths, which is a considerable increase over previous year. And about two-thirds of those were due to opioids. And that's one problem. The other problem, and this is really recent, we're talking about the last couple of weeks, we have seen fentanyl being mixed with illegal pills, pain pills. And because fentanyl is so much powerful, that's really dangerous. Fentanyl is also being mixed with methamphetamines. And while there is treatment for overdose, there's several drugs like naloxone that states have allowed to be used. There's no treatment for methamphetamine. So what you're getting is you're getting the methamphetamine effect and you're getting the fentanyl effect. And that's a massive effect, which is not good for the health of the person who's using that. So the problem hasn't gone away, but up until recently, it has been sort of hidden by the COVID epidemic, which, you know, we're over 700,000 deaths in a year. So clearly it's more significant than the opioid epidemic, but the opioid epidemic has this 20-year range, of which it's been a problem. So I don't think we're putting enough money. I don't think there are enough treatment programs. Treatment for addicts is really difficult anyway. I know somebody, and I'm not going to go into the nature of this, who is a meth addict for 21 years, who has now been clean for the last 3 or 4 years, and he did it on his own. That's really rare. What you have is people who go into addiction treatment, and maybe they go through it, maybe they don't. They come out, they're okay for a while, and then they start taking again. So they'll go into it 4, 5, 6, 7 times, and maybe they'll get cured of the addiction and maybe not. But there aren't enough treatment facilities. The treatment facilities, the private ones, are particularly expensive. So we don't have enough treatment. There's still interdiction. The DEA recently confiscated enough. Well, I don't have the numbers because I don't have it right in front of me, but a massive amount of fentanyl that they said could just by itself could have killed a lot of people. So, you know, the stuff is still going on. We're still doing the interdiction. We're probably not doing as much incarceration with the opioid epidemic as we did with particularly the crack cocaine epidemic, which really led to a massive increase in the incarceration in the United States. A cocaine epidemic, not so much. What you have instead are lawsuits. And, you know, that is another subject that we can go into.
Yeah, I see. I wouldn't want to skip the before last chapter, speaking about the global context. I've got basically two questions. So first of all, you choose there's several countries that you mentioned. It's Canada, Mexico, India, Nigeria, and West Africa, I believe. Why these countries? How have they been hit as a consequence, I guess, of the U.S. epidemic?
Okay. Let's start with Canada. Canada, as I mentioned earlier, is number two in opioid epidemics and deaths and so forth, mostly in the Western region. Their system is, their health system is different from ours. So they could actually pay for treatment if they were doing the treatment. But they were also subject to marketing. They were subject to television and, you know, all of the things that went on in the United States, you could see in Canada. Purdue, and I got it right this time, saying Purdue first, had a marketing company called Mundi Pharma. And so when their market for prescription opioids started contracting a little bit, they looked to overseas markets, and Canada was a good place to do that. And there's a lot of, I don't want to offend any of my Canadian friends, there's a lot of resemblance between the United States and Canada. And, we share this long border, which for the most part is unguarded until, I guess, the fairly recently. And so that's why that was picked. Mexico was picked because they have a lot of drug issues. Plus, they're involved very much in trafficking. And we wanted to get a Latin American perspective on this. Interesting about these other three countries, Mexico, India, and Nigeria, they don't have the drug problem, drug use problem. It's more of manufacturing and selling. Little bit of exception in India and Nigeria, if there's any opioid addiction, it's to a weaker opioid called tramadol, which I know from my pet's experience. I've had a dog that was on tramadol, and I said he's an opioid addict. You know, I have one of those in my house. But Mexico was a source of trafficking for cocaine, for example. They're a source of black tar heroin into the United States. Sam Canona's books spells that out very nicely. They have become an increasing source of manufacturing fentanyl, though the major source of fentanyl is the People's Republic of China. So that was Mexico. India, I think partly was because my co-author, Dr. Patel, is originally from India. There's, to the extent that there's any addiction issues, it's, again, tramadol, but they're the major manufacturer of tramadol. And they're also in the northern areas, there's a lot of trafficking in northern India. And some of that trafficking goes through Nigeria and some of the West African countries. And so, again, there's some addiction, interestingly, more among women in Nigeria than among men. But there's been a big, I hate to use the word crackdown, on drugs in Nigeria due to a lot of pressure from the United States. United States works with other countries through international organizations and with one-on-one diplomacy and foreign aid and things like that to stem traffic. And, you know, and then the country that we didn't talk about that we should is Afghanistan. They're the major grower of opium in the world. And while the Taliban, when it first was in power, tried to cut back on it, and when the United States came in and overthrew the Taliban regime and tried to get the farmers to move off of opioid farming, turns out that opium farming is just much more easier and more profitable than doing, you know, the cash crop kind of thing. But you don't see the addiction in these other countries as much because there's a cultural bias against doing that. In India, for example, it's, you know, using these alternative Eastern techniques for dealing with things like pain. In the United States, we have a culture of, I don't feel well, there's got to be a pill to deal with that or some other medication. So taking pills and all of the advertisement, direct-to-consumer advertising that we have, you got in Canada, they were watching American TV, but you don't have in Mexico, Nigeria, or India. To the extent that there's in Mexico, there's addiction, it tends to be in the areas that border the southern United States. So that's the picture of these four countries. That's why we picked those four countries.
Yeah, makes sense. So, well, what you just said, it does lead into what I always wonder about. I'm from the Netherlands, Western European, and in a certain sense, we see ourselves as sort of similar to the Americans, I would say. The other day, I had the opportunity to go to a talk by Mr. Patrick Grannan Keefe, who did the book Empire of Pain on the Sackler family, and so. You present a big piece of the puzzle, like it's the policy that enabled the opioid crises. Mr. Keefe says, well, it's also a large part is the agency of such a big and powerful family with their marketing apparatus. Do you think that there's let me state it like this. Do you think Americans in general are in more pain than most other people?
Oh, I don't see how anybody could possibly say that.
I see.
Humans are humans. It doesn't matter where they are. I don't think we have a market on pain in the United States.
Mm-hmm. We're all very sensitive to the opioid seductions.
Well, I don't think, you know, you don't really see it in Western, for that matter, or Eastern Europe, the opioid. I think part of that is there's much more regulation of pharmaceuticals in Europe than there is in the United States. And it's not just prices, you know, what can be used and how much and things like that. And we don't do very much of that.
No, it makes perfect sense. All right. Well, we're already almost at an hour. Thanks so much for this big introduction, the overview of the book. There's so much more in there, but well, I guess that's up to the listeners to read that for themselves. Before we leave, I would like to ask you, what are you currently working on? Is it with your colleague?
We have a book in mind. And that's as far as it goes. From my part, Patel has a book kind of sketched out, and we're kind of waiting for things to settle down with this one that looks at the issue of partisanship in the United States. And we have, and I'm not going to say what the angle is on that, but it's an interesting angle on things, and you can see this in. Things like the pandemic and how it's being viewed and how it's being regulated in different parts of the country, and that's I think going to be our next project.
All right.
Of course, at some point we're going to totally retire from doing any of this stuff, but we're not quite there yet.
All right. Well, let's hope that lasts for a little longer. Thanks so much for this great talk, and we'll talk next time. Who knows?
Thank you. I enjoyed this.